You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the NL West. Hello, everyone. I'm Allison Footer from MLB.com. And as we look at the NL West this week, it was mostly all about the draft, except for one team. The San Francisco Giants. Chris Heston picked the second night of the draft to throw a no-hitter, the fourth no-hitter for the Giants in 4 years. So that was very exciting. And in San Diego, they're still sort of trying to figure out who they are and what they are. And they're making a couple of different roster moves and trying to stay in the race. And of course, the Los Angeles Dodgers are never an uninteresting team, still trying to figure out that bullpen and how to bridge the gap to the closer, Kenley Jansen, who is coming back from injury and has had some good days and some bad days. So that is a quick look at the NL West.
Here to talk a little draft and a little Dodgers with Ken Gernick, who just covered everything for MLB.com. So Ken, I was just talking to Thomas Harding with the Rockies, and I was saying that the only really advanced work I do on the draft is just waiting for Jonathan Mayo and Jim Callis to tell me who did well, who didn't do well, what players are good. And Jim says that the Dodgers really had one of the top five drafts this year, so he was pretty impressed with the players that the Dodgers got. Those top couple of picks, seems that the Dodgers think they might be fast-tracked a little bit and might even be with the team next year. So that's pretty impressive. What did you learn about those two pitchers that they got? Two pitchers, right?
Two right-handed pitchers, and they pretty much stayed with the college pitching throughout the draft, and that seemed to be their trend. It's a way to restock the system. You know, the Dodger farm system is kind of top-heavy. They've got a couple really good prospects, but it's kind of thin after that. Well, it might not be as thin as it was. It shouldn't be anyway. They drafted pretty much college almost all the way through, pitching almost all the way through, and the top two guys, Buehler and Funkhauser, they think will come quickly. They're advanced. They're mature. They may not be the very very top of their class. But the Dodgers feel, the new Dodger management team feels, that they can move quickly, that they might be considered depth as early as next year. But they're thinking of them more as far as helping the big league club quickly compared to past Dodger drafts under a different management regime, where they very often went with high school and more projectable kind of high ceiling type guys, either boom or bust, Kershaw, or is the type of guy that you never hear of. This draft seems to be more guys that may not wind up being Cy Young MVPs, but they might get here quicker and stay longer.
And it's hard to really project, like, over time, like, what the team's needs might be, like, years from now. But, I mean, you have to look at a correlation between the fact that they need rotation help. And of course these guys won't be able to help them this year, but that had to have factored into that, just kind of looking maybe at the top, at the AAA level at this point with the starting pitching they have and problems that they're having in the rotation, that probably was in their minds too. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, that's kind of the view from the outside. Oddly enough, they claim that they went into this draft looking for hitters. But either there weren't that many of them or they didn't get to their slot. But the new scouting director, Billy Gasparino, said, if you had asked me before the draft, I would have said we'd probably wind up with more hitters than pitchers, and that wasn't the case. So, who knows? The whole draft is a crapshoot. It's fun to watch, but it's impossible to predict. And, if 10% of your draft picks make it to the big leagues, that's considered kind of the norm, and 10% is not high at almost anything you do. So, it just goes to show that that the draft really is kind of throw the darts and hope that they hit the right names. I'm sure that the better ones come out, the better draft coordinators come out a little bit ahead than the worst ones, but even the best ones would have to say you need a lot of luck. And the Dodgers are hoping that they get lucky with this draft because their farm system depth-wise can use it.
Yeah, it's funny when you listen to them talk about that, when you kind of have them go pick by pick and talk about them and you know, you walk away kind of convinced that everyone's going to make the big leagues. But as you said, very few actually do. So let's talk about what's going on with the Dodgers. I guess the bullpen, I mean, we've talked about it a lot. They're still kind of looking for, now that they have their closer back, so they're looking for the bridge to Jansen, which is it's still not going that well. I was kind of paying attention to last Sunday. The eighth inning is still kind of giving them problems. They're managing to win games still, but is that still as much of an issue as it always was?
Yeah, nothing's changed since last year. I mean, the names and faces have changed, but the results seem to be the same. It's very inconsistent. They've had their share of injuries, but, you know, who hasn't? They're hoping to get Peralta back maybe in the next week or so. Same thing with Brandon League. That should help. You know, they've been going with three rookies. They've actually done a decent job, but Yimi Garcia, who was really good in April, hasn't been good since. Liberatore has been good, not quite as good as he was in April. But Frias has been in the rotation. He was kind of a swing guy. He's really taken hold of a rotation spot, as has Bolsinger. But both of those guys could have factored into the bullpen, Frias especially. But they were needed in the rotation. So that cut down on their depth when they had the injuries. And of course, they went the first 6 weeks without Kenley Jansen. He came back strong, but gave up a home run last night and blew a save. So, it's kind of a shell game down there as to, you know, who's the next one. Don Mattingly, you know, a lot of people criticize him for going with Hatcher, who was acquired during the offseason basically to fill that role. He can only play the cards he's dealt, and he really hasn't been dealt a very strong hand as far as the bullpen goes. So he's been mixing and matching. They've still been right up there at the top of the division. So, you know, it's easy to criticize him, but, it's not so easy to make a call when you really don't trust anybody down there, and that seems to be the case right now.
There's been a lot of chatter about just the fact that they've not done well against the Cardinals and the Giants this year. And from a fan standpoint, I mean, you know, those are the teams that you feel like you're kind of need to get through to either win a division or get through the playoffs, and they've been a nemesis of the Dodgers. Does it matter, from a Dodger standpoint, like from the player standpoint, do you think it matters to them, like which teams are losing to or which teams are beating, or is just the fact that when they just, you know, lose like 4 out of 6 regardless, that is the most bothersome to them? Does it matter that they've not done well against the Cardinals and Giants?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's in their head now. And, it's been, especially with the Cardinals, you know, going on 3 years now. So it's more than a fluke. It's pretty established that when they go head-to-head, the Cardinals are a better team. And the Dodgers are going to have to prove, especially their offense is going to have to prove that they can beat a good pitching staff. They haven't done it this year. I mean, that's just the fact. You know, it doesn't mean they can't do it, doesn't mean they won't do it, but it does mean they haven't done it, and that's where they are. And so it's not just in the heads of the fans and the media, but they know it. They know that they struggle every time they come up against a good team, and it's a hurdle they're going to have to clear, like you said, if they want to go anywhere in the postseason.
Yeah, it is interesting because you don't think about those kinds of things really getting into a team's head, but it certainly does. I mean, it does carry a stigma. There's one last thing I want to ask you about, I'm just curious. I read so much coverage when I'm preparing for these podcasts. I'm reading everything written about every team that I have. And the one thing that I've noticed, it didn't hit me until recently, is very rarely are the general manager and the president, and I never can say his name, Farhan Zaidi and Andrew Friedman, they're, like, never quoted. Is there, like, a certain set of rules, or is it just Mattingly who just speaks on behalf of the team, or is it just sort of missing when these guys are quoted? I feel like I never read them, like, really being quoted on anything.
Yeah, I don't think they want to be quoted. They're basically invisible, really. They are reachable on certain occasions, but they pick and choose when they choose to be. I think the way that it's set up, they want Mattingly to be the spokesman. Of course, the problem there is very often he's getting into areas that he knows are not under his control, and then he just says, well, that's a question for Andrew or Farhan, And, you know, he just or it might be a medical question. And he says, well, that's a medical question. You know, even so, the Dodgers are very good at wanting to have it both ways, where you have to go to one guy to get all the information. But it's easy for him to say, I don't have that information. And then you're back to square one. And, you know, that's just the way they handle it. You know, it's their team and they can do it any way they please. And that's the way they choose.
Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, it's really – that's not just, like, completely on the Dodgers. I mean, there's other teams where the general manager wants to be the only one that's really quoted on anything, besides the manager talking about the games, of course. And then, like, some most teams, like the training staffs, are not allowed to be on the record. And the Astros have decided the coaches can't go on the record unless it's been approved through the team. I mean, everyone has their funny little things. But it's taken me this long, like, having these weekly conversations with you to realize that I never see these guys quoted anywhere. I just thought that was somewhat interesting. So – I wanted to ask you about it. Boy, oh boy, do we have some things to talk about with Chris Haft, who covers the Giants for MLB.com. And just to give the listeners out there some context, so when the draft comes around, basically the MLB.com mantra is nothing else matters. All hands on deck, draft, 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 draft. And so all of the beat writers, regardless of where the teams are that they're covering, where they're playing, they are in the city where the draft is going on, covering the draft. Okay, so let's fast forward to, I believe it was the second day of the draft, and so our friend Chris Haft was in San Francisco. The Giants were in New York, and Chris Heston throws a no-hitter. And my first thought was, oh, my God, I'm so happy for Chris Heston for throwing a no-hitter. My second thought was, oh, my God, Chris Haft has missed this no-hitter because he's covering the draft. So, Chris, you've been around for quite a while. You've seen a lot. How are you feeling when you're watching this, or knowing that it's going on? I'm sure you were furiously typing, covering the draft, but, what was your reaction when you were learning of the, this no hitter going on in New York?
I gotta admit, I had quite a mixture of feelings. I was happy for Jamal, my, replacement there, because he's a young writer, and I was thinking, oh, Jamal gets to cover a potential no-hitter. That would be a great thing for a guy who's in his early 20s. I honestly and truly felt that way. Did I feel a little bit of selfishness wishing I was there? Of course I did. I don't know if I'd be human if I didn't. Back on the other hand, I've been really blessed. I've seen or covered, because I went to a couple as a spectator, as a fan, 7 no-hitters. A lot of people don't even get to see one. So, you know, as far as no-hitters go, I've been quite a wealthy witness, I guess you'd say. So, you know what? It's all working out in the end.
Yeah. And, I mean, really, it's so exciting. Of course, it's really exciting when it happens when the player's at his home ballpark. But it's really cool when you see it progressing into, like, the eighth inning, you know, when they're on the road and the fans start noticing what's happening and they kind of get behind it. They're like, okay, we love our team, but we could witness history here. You start to hear the cheers go up a little bit. So, you know, Chris Heston, God bless him. I mean, anybody can throw a no-hitter at any time. This is not the most likely guy that I would have picked to throw first no-hitter of 2015. So we've talked about him in the past. You know, a 27-year-old rookie, he didn't even make the team out of spring training. He was pushed into the duty because the starting rotation was depleted by 2 or 3 guys. He was just on, I guess, right? I mean, he's got great stuff, but we certainly weren't expecting this.
He was on, Allison, but that's just what you also hit on. He's been so erratic this year. 5 or 6 starts where he's given up 5 earned runs or more. 5 or 6 starts where he's given up 1 or 0 runs, you know, heading into this game. And lately it's been more of the 5-run variety in his performances. So all of a sudden he just does a total 180-degree about-face and you know, throws this kind of game. My gosh. I mean, it sounds like a pitching cliche, but when he keeps his stuff down, he's awfully tough to hit.
Yeah. He, in that last inning was just pretty amazing, just striking out the side. I mean, just baffling him still. Just baffling. I mean, he just looked baffled in the ninth inning.
Yeah. You know, something else about being an older rookie, you know, he has spent a lot of time in the minors, and unlike a lot of guys these days, position players or pitchers, who are rushed to the majors, he had to spend a lot of time down in, you know, double, triple A, learning how to pitch. And I think all that, you know, I guess you would say that maybe there's a case of delayed gratification. I think all that time in the minors really helped him.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting, and it's neat when it happens to the guy that you wouldn't expect. Now, moving on to a guy that we always expect great things from, Hunter Pence. Is he heading back to the disabled list? What's happening with him?
It sure seems like it. You know, when he came back from that fractured left forearm, somebody asked him, are you going to have a problem swinging because you swing so violently? This was essentially the question. And Hunter said, no, it won't be a problem at all. And, of course, we all believed him blindly. But and he won't. Nobody will really admit that this is related to the forearm. But Mike Kruko, the Giants' fine color commentator, pointed out, you know, he had that thing immobilized for so long. You know, it had to have done something, not make the tendons necessarily, you know, brittle or whatever, but, you know, things had to be immobilized in there. And so all of a sudden they're being put into, you know, very, you know, violent motion. And maybe there is, so maybe he was suggesting maybe there is some effect, you know, from the fracture to what he's going through, what Hunter's going through now. They've done awfully well on this road trip. You know, they've won games without Hunter Pence, but over the long haul, you know, they don't have, you know, this guy who hits in the middle of the order consistently. It's going to be difficult for him.
I would imagine that it's a little bit easier for the Giants to swallow that, knowing that they've gotten back on track. I can imagine how devastating it would be if they were still sort of doing what they were doing the first 3 weeks of the season to miss him again.
Well, that's a good point. You know, Justin Maxwell has filled in very well. They're getting excellent offense from just about every other position. My gosh, Nori Aoki is an all-star candidate in left field. Angel Pagansen, very solid in center. Matt Duffy, pretty soon people are going to start talking about him as a Rookie of the Year candidate. I'm not sure now offhand. I'm going to sound dumb here. I'm not sure if he is a rookie technically because he got some time last year. But Joe Panik's not a rookie, but this is his first full year, and he's been one of the best second basemen in the league. Buster Posey's having a Buster Posey type of year, driving in a lot of runs and playing solid defense behind the plate. And Brandon Belt's been no slouch at first. So up and down the lineup, you know, they're getting contributions, and that's just a hallmark of a Bruce Bochy team.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all know by now they're going to be just fine, regardless of the ups and downs of the season. I've been talking about the draft to start off my podcast with most of the reporters, but of course we had a no-hitter to talk about. So I do want to touch on the draft. 19, and so almost half of all the players that's drafted are college pitchers. That seems like a lot, like more than the norm.
Yeah, I don't, you know, they didn't say it was a lot, but I think it's a lot. But you know what? Those guys are, they're marketable in one way or another. They're either going to help you or they're going to help some other team in a trade because they develop quickly. And, of course, this is, even though, you know, teams can say all they want about, you know, taking the time to develop, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it's a results-based business, and people want quick results. And these college pitchers can maybe develop in 2-3 years, sometimes less. There was a guy named Tim Lincecum who they drafted out of the University of Washington in 2006. And by the following year, he was doing some pretty remarkable stuff. And less than 2 years later, in 2008, he was winning a Cy Young Award. So not that everybody's going to be that, accelerated or, you know, precocious, to use a big word, in their development. But you can have that. You've got a chance for that with a college pitcher. And if you need somebody, if you need maybe a position player in a trade, and you've got a good, well-developed pitcher on your, who you can, afford to part with, then you're going to get that position player, and the pitcher still will have helped you. It just maybe not directly, but in strengthening your lineup, by being used in a trade.
Yeah, it is interesting to see some of the trends. It just seems like there's a lot more college players just across the board than there were high school. I could be off on that, but I don't know. Maybe a little bit less risk and more signability, and who really knows? But it seems like teams really are more like, let's win now, win quickly, and just get them through the system and get them up here and see what happens.
Right. The risk thing is that really is a big factor, as you mentioned. But they also drafted a high school pitcher named Madison Bumgarner in 2007. Look how that turned out.
Yeah, he's pretty good. I think he's a keeper.
Yeah.
All right. Well, very good. Well, Chris, thank you. I hope that it stays exciting, but I hope that the next no-hitter thrown is in San Francisco so you can be there. Keep my fingers crossed for you.
I hope so,
thank
too.
You so
thanks
much.
For,
we'll
thanks for
you
your concern.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris. Take care. Here with my friend Corey Brock, who covers the Padres and just covered the Padres draft for MLB.com. And so, Corey, I love, you go through and you read the coverage from everyone, and everyone is sort of tasked with finding interesting angles and things that people want to read about. The Padres draft class, as you have said, was full of extra large athletes. 17 players, 6'4" or taller. Which, could tell you a lot or tell you a little bit, but it is nice to see, bigger, stronger, faster, I guess, come into the organization.
Yeah, it's, who knows what this will all mean in the long run. And, they've assured me that this was purely by coincidence. I'm not entirely sure that's the case, Allison. I think probably a lot of the guys they targeted are, larger framed athletes, whether that be pitchers or position players. Now, most of them are pitchers, these wide-bodied, large-frame guys with big live arms. A lot of these guys they targeted in the draft and drafted a few of them, and then some big position players as well. I'm kind of intrigued by this kid I wrote about in the 15th round they picked yesterday out of a JUCO in Florida. He's a big left-handed hitting first baseman. He went to the University of Miami as a freshman, skipped his senior year of high school, so he's only 19 years old, but a big guy with a lot of power. So, you kind of look at these trends that these teams pick, and, a lot of pitchers, a lot of big athletes, a lot of quick athletes and catchers. I don't know if there's any one way to go about, putting together a draft list. I think you truly have a list of guys you like, and then some of them are gone and some of them are available. And so we don't really know what to make of any of these guys for 4 or 5 years anyway. But I know the Padres and, their first-year scouting director feel pretty good about what they came up with.
So only 7 of 39 picks were high school players, which seems to be really low. Is that – has there ever been a – I mean, obviously it's
Yeah. No, I think that's fair, Allison. I think – really, maybe there's only going to maybe be a couple of those guys that maybe really truly have a chance to sign. A few of the other ones were kind of middle rounds toward later, so I have to think they have, college commitments that they might try and honor. It might be hard to kind of push them off that. But, their first overall pick, I should say, it was their second round pick, but it was their first pick. A big right-handed pitcher out of a high school in Florida, Austin Smith, he was one of the high school kids they picked. I think they'll sign him. There was an outfielder from Florida, last name McGee. He's a leadoff hitter kind of guy, a good athlete, kind of fits, I think, a lot of the things A.J. Preller wants to get in the system. Quick athletes, maybe guys you can move around. This guy's a potential to make you play some second base, too. So I don't know if there's exactly an A.J. Preller-type player yet, and I'm not exactly sure what his imprint was on the draft. I know he was heavily involved in it, but certainly has his hands full presiding over the major league team as well. So we'll give it a few years. The sample size is still pretty small, but I thought that was a little curious too, Allison. So you would be inclined to think with these college guys, they might move a little bit quicker throughout the system.
Yeah, I mean, that is a risk too. I mean, and you know, for the top picks, I mean, there's a very strong relationship that is formed between the scouts and the players. It's not like they just show up to a couple games right before the draft. I mean, they're following these guys through the years. They know very well if they're going to be able, you know, their signability, as they say. But it is more of a risk. I mean, you get to, like, the later rounds, and there's still guys you want, but you are competing against the colleges that they want to go to. And it's harder to really determine, like, ultimately how they're going to go. And so that is a risk to take, like, more high school players than college.
Yeah, it's one the Padres and a lot of teams have dealt with. And I'll go back a few years to when the team took Austin Hedges in the second round. You know, he's from a high school just north of here in San Juan Capistrano. Well, he was a very strong UCLA commit. And the thought was, you know, this guy was regarded as the top defensive catcher in the entire draft. And, you know, the moment he signed, he was probably one of the top defensive catchers in all the minor leagues, you know. And Austin Hedges, of course, is already up with the Padres. He was recalled this year, rookie catcher. But just a little background on him. But, you know, the Padres drafted him in the second round, and, you know, with no, like, full assurance that they were going to be able to get him to move off that college commitment to UCLA, which is one of the top programs in the country. But, you know, they were able to scrimp and save with a few other picks and throw some money at him. And lo and behold, he signed, you know, at a place where, you know, thought he was a first-round talent, but he was able to get to the second round because I think a lot of teams thought he was really firmly committed to UCLA. So, yeah, I think that's kind of where you these scouts, you know, I've always kind of likened it, Allison. I think scouts are a little bit like reporters in the sense now where they really have to do their due diligence with developing sources and background on these guys. Josh Burns, the former general manager of the Padres, gave me a great line that he stole from, I think, a GM of an NFL team. Says something akin, I can't remember it, and I'll butcher it, of course, but something like, you know, if you're not talking to the school janitor, you're not doing your job, you know. So, like, you know, and so you need to know that, heck, if I'm going to pick this guy, you know, there's a chance he could sign, but, you know, you feel pretty good that you've done your due diligence, you've talked to enough people, and I'm not just talking to his high school coach, who's going to say all sorts of wonderful things about him, but you kind of got to get to that next layer, kind of like reporters, you got to get to that next level of sources, and you got to get yourself the full picture, and you talk to enough people, and you can be able to paint yourself a full picture and get a better understanding of the person you're trying to deal with. Or like in our cases, like if we're writing a feature story, the profile we're trying to write, you get a better understanding of a person with the more people you talk to.
Yeah, no doubt. Is it alarming at all? I just look at, even though they didn't have to get rid of, like, all of their talent to build the major league team this year, the fact that they didn't get to even pick until 51 overall because of the James Shields signing, the obtaining Craig Kimbrell in a trade. I say this, I have some experience just having watched the Astros, the beginning of the end of their minor league system really started with having signed like type A free agents. Of course, I don't have those now, but just sort of not picking in the early rounds, and you do that enough, they can come back to get you. I'm not saying that's going to be what's happening with the Padres, but is there any concern just because they didn't get to start even picking until people were already two players in?
Yeah, you know, I think that was kind of the risk-reward you run with when you dabble in trading draft picks as they did with Kimbrell and certainly signing James Shields and losing a draft pick that way. So, you know, I thought, you know, I talked to Mark Connor, their first-year scouting director, and I asked him about this. And, you know, just sort of jokingly, like, hey, you accepted this job back in the fall when you still had the 13th overall pick and the 41st pick. And lo and behold, you know, you end up losing both of those. And, you know, and he said that, you know, another scouting director or a different scout kind of put it to him this way. He says, hey, look at it this way. Your 13th overall pick was James Shields, and your 41st overall pick was Craig Kimbrell. And so, you know, right. Maybe that's an oversimplification. But you know, essentially all these players, all these draft picks, everything serves to benefit the major league team, whether that's eventually or if it's today. And, you know, the Padres were trying to get better today when they made both those deals, when they signed Shields in February and certainly when they traded for Kimbrel a day before opening day. And I don't know if it's essentially mortgaging their future, maybe a little bit. You know, I like a lot of the players they moved in those deals. I think some of those players are going to help other teams. You know, also we saw Joe Ross the other day, Tyson Ross's younger brother, make his major league debut for the Nationals. They really like Joe Ross. I think he's going to be a very good major league pitcher. So, so there's going to be some of those guys are going to end up in the big leagues helping other teams. So it just kind of happens that way. But, I think one of the things that kind of made it a little easier to digest for the Padres was that maybe this draft wasn't really filled with top-tier guys at the very top. I think there's probably going to be some solid major league players throughout the draft, but at least at the very top, they don't feel like they missed out on a whole lot by not having a guy at 13 or 41.
Right. Yeah, it's a lot of guessing anyway, but as long as they don't have too many of those drafts in a row, I think they're going to, you know, end up being okay. I wanted to ask about Jed Gurko. So recently optioned to AAA. This is sort of slowly building. I mean, you could kind of feel this maybe coming at some point. Were you surprised at all?
Yeah. No, and not surprised. I mean, I think it was going to happen. He had sort of been reduced to a role where he was only starting against left-handed pitchers. And you know how the big leagues works. I mean, you can go several weeks at a time without facing any of these guys, or you could face three of them on consecutive days. So, but more often than not, you're not seeing a whole lot of these guys. So, and the Padres had gone through a stretch where they hadn't seen a left-hander in a long time. So, he really struggled. He's gotten off to slow starts ever since he's been in the big leagues. And since he's told me, ever since he's been in professional baseball, and he's always kind of hit his way out of it, but he hasn't so far. He's going to get a chance to go to AAA and play every day and work on some of the things he worked on here, which is not expanding the strike zone, work on his, work on attacking right-handed pitching and using all fields and just trying to find that stroke that works so well for him his rookie year. So, by no means have they given up on Jed Gurko. He's still a relatively young player. There's still some money left on that contract, certainly, that he signed last April. And, he has a lot of pride. And I know in my conversations with him that this bothers him, and he wants to fix it. You know, he's not sitting around moping in the clubhouse or looking over his shoulder. He's putting in the extra time before the games with the hitting coaches, watching video. He's trying to get better. Maybe this is a chance for him to step back in order to take a step forward. So we'll kind of monitor that as we move throughout here. But, it's always a little strange when a guy that's been around for so long, so to speak, is no longer with the big league club.
Right. Yeah, well, there's still plenty of time for him. But anyway, Corey, thank you so much. And enjoy your time off. It's coming up, and we'll talk to you when you get back. Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the Arizona Diamondbacks. I am Allison Sutter from MLB.com, here for my every other day chat with Steve Gilbert, whose Diamondbacks are constantly making news, I just see. So, I really want to start with Wellington Castillo, and here's why. Not because for any reason except that he was with the Cubs in spring training, and he was up to bat, and this is the Will Ferrell tour through all the spring training games where he played. He appeared in 10 games, and he in 5 games for 10 teams, played every position, and all went to charity, and it was just great fun. And so Will Ferrell was coaching third base at the Cubs game, and the signs, so he was giving signs, and he actually brought his own signs, and the sign that he gave to Wellington was, "You are a very handsome man," and Wellington gave him a thumbs up. So, I thought that was really fun. So I wanted to just pass along that anecdote, but what I wanted to talk to you about was the fact that he had a really forgettable debut, but then a really good game a couple days later, and he actually won a game for the Diamondbacks. So, why don't we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, he struck out 4 times in his debut, and, you immediately get the questions on Twitter, did they really need this guy, and why do they think this guy is the answer, and on and on. And Chip Hale, you know, said after the game, yeah, you know, we still think he's going to hit. You know, he's got to get more consistent at bats, and so he's going to be in there tomorrow. And he was in there the next day and ended up hitting what proved to be the game-winning home run. So he's somebody that they like his bat. They like the way he works behind the plate. And they, quite frankly, had a need for a catcher. And so that was the direction that they decided to go. And so far, so good for him, even after that rough debut.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. He wasn't playing a whole lot with the Mariners, right? He had his playing time had it wasn't really that great. Am I correct?
Right. And he okay. wasn't playing very much early in the year with the Cubs either, because they had three catchers. And so he wasn't getting, you know, consistent at bats at that time either. So really this whole year, he hasn't gotten consistent at bats. And so right now, you know, with his, you know, alternating with Salton Lamaki, is probably going to be the most consistent playing time he's gotten in, since maybe last year.
It makes me laugh because we do often in this, from a fandom standpoint, we do forget that these guys are human beings, and that perhaps the change of scenery, the frenetic, you know, last-minute trade, finding out that you're going here and you're not going there, that perhaps, you know, an 0-for-4 was going to happen, which doesn't really serve as a precursor. Here in Houston, Evan Gattis had this horrendous start to the season. He was like 0-for-14, and he struck out like 8 times, and fans were booing him, and everyone was losing their minds, and now all of a sudden, of course, 2 months later, Evan Gattis is one of the best hitters on the team. So sometimes they just need to settle in a little bit, would you say?
Yeah, especially when you're talking about a trade in the middle of the season. You know, guys probably found housing wherever it was he was playing, and now if they have families, they have to, you know, deal with uprooting them too in the middle of the season. And, you know, Mark Trumbo was standing in front of his locker talking with us the night of the trade, and someone asked him about, you know, something, and he said, well, my biggest concern right now is, you know, just getting a flight and, you know, finding out where I'm going to stay initially in Seattle. So you're right. I mean, it's not like just moving Strat-O-Matic cards on the board.
Right.
These guys actually have lives, and they have to get to these new cities and kind of settle in, and all that, you know, all that does play a role in that.
Yeah, it can, you know, it can mess with your head a little bit for a day or two, and then you get settled in, and then things improve. So you think that he's going to split time with Salton Lamaki? There's not going to really be like a front liner here in the early going?
You know, I think if one of them ends up taking off, you know, and kind of claims the job, then it would be. But I think for right now, they're kind of content to play both of them and see which one kind of, you know, takes off.
Okay. Let's move on to Josh Colemanter. So he's giving up a lot of home runs lately, which in his first 5 starts, he only gave up 1 home run. And now it seems like the long balls are becoming a little bit of an issue. 3 solo shots on Sunday that led off innings. And he's 0-3 with a 7.76 ERA in his last 6 starts. So does he know what's happening with him? Does he know why this shift? And is this worrisome?
Well, probably a little bit of both. I think he's just not, you know, he doesn't have a lot of velocity to start with. You know, he throws in the mid, maybe upper 80s. So he doesn't have a lot of margin for error. A lot of times when you throw in the 90s, if you miss your spot with a pitch, you know, you can get away with it because of that velocity. But when you're throwing in the mid 80s, you don't have as much margin for error. And right now, he's missing a lot up and out over the plate, which is just trouble. And especially given the stuff that he has. And if you looked at the bunch of the homers he gave up on Sunday, that's what they were. They were on balls that were up and out over the middle of the plate. So for him, it really comes down to location, and it's been a recurring pattern for him, unfortunately for him so far this season, where he's missing his spots and leaving pitches up. So it's something he's got to get worked out here relatively quickly. Because he's been counting on to be the ace of the staff, and right now, you know, he's just not.
And I want to ask you about Jake Lamb. So he's back, and what is the schedule for him? Like, sometimes when they bring a position player back, he's been out a while, he'll kind of take a little easy. He'll play a couple games, be off for one, play 3, be off for one. Is there any kind of schedule like that for him?
You know, I found it interesting that Chip Hale said that, you know, this stress reaction that he had in his foot, Chip kind of blamed himself a little bit for it, saying maybe he played him a little too much during spring training before he was really ready. So I think they're going to monitor his workload initially. And so, you know, you'll see him play some third with Tomas in right field, and then you'll see him get a day off and Yasmani Tomas start at third base. So I think you're going to see that for a little bit before he starts playing him, you know, every day consistently for a week at a time. I think he's going to be cautious with him, at least initially.
Okay, well, that is our Diamondbacks update. And, Steve, I'll try to go a couple days without having to contact you, but you can tell your team to stop making news, and then we can give you a little bit of a break. But thank you, and we will talk to you soon.
All right, look forward to it, Allison.
Right. I'm with Thomas Harding, who covered the draft for the Rockies for MLB.com, and now we're going to talk to you, Thomas, a little bit about that before we move on to the actual team that is playing for the Rockies right now. Jim Pallas, who is one of our colleagues, and really when it comes to the draft, I pretty much pay very little attention until Jonathan Mayo and Jim Pallas tell me who's good, who's bad, who had a good draft, who didn't have a good draft. And the Colorado Rockies, according to Mr. Pallas, had one of the top five drafts this year, and actually only second to Houston. So you seem to be pretty high on the high picks that the Rockies pick. Is that the impression that you came away with after covering this?
Yes, I came away with a very good impression of what they drafted, especially what we've seen from this team about getting the best guy available. And if you look at the very top of the draft, of course, they drafted third, which shows you that they didn't have a very good year on the field last year. But they drafted third overall, and they ended up getting Brendan Rodgers, who was going into it by a lot of people's standards, the best player available. What happened, the two teams in front of them, the Diamondbacks and the Astros, picked college shortstops. And a lot of times those guys get there quicker, so teams will go ahead and draft maybe what they think is a little bit sure of a thing. But when you look at talent level and what scouts think of them, Brendan Rodgers was the best player in this draft. I mean, he's 18 years old, although when you see the pictures and video of him, he looks like a major leaguer already, just in the way he plays and his facial look. But he's a guy that could really make a difference for this franchise, and that's what you want at the top. And then you start looking at a couple of high school pitchers that they've got up high in the draft. They're guys who already have pretty good pitch mixes here, which usually you don't have that from high school guys. But Mike Nikorak from Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, you know, he was a compensation pick. And this is a guy who's big. He's 6'5", but he throws hard, like in the 94 range. But he also has a knuckle curveball. And you just keep looking at guys, and you're thinking, wait a second here. It looks like they hit on some good material to work with. Now, is this the type of material that's going to make a huge difference in the major leagues? A lot can happen along that way, as we see with injuries and non-performance and things like that. But guys like Nikorak and Peter Lambert from San Dimas, California, and Javier Medina from Tucson, Arizona, these are guys who not just throw the ball hard, or even if they don't throw the ball hard, they have a pretty good pitch mix already, even though they're high school kids.
It seems like I've never really heard any team say, we're not going to take the best player available. We're actually aiming to find this position. We are, you know, we're kind of low on this position. I mean, have you ever heard any team actually say anything except we're looking to take the best player available?
Well, I think you see two things in a draft. It's not drafting for position, because that would be foolhardy. You know, you've got to have players, and a lot of the players that you draft don't end up in the same position. But sometimes teams will lean toward college over high school. So those are, I think, the two determining factors. Some teams would rather have college guys. They get to the majors quicker. Some teams would rather have a mix of college and high school guys. And the thing about the high school guys is, yeah, you wait longer on most of them, but the ones who do make it quicker, they give you more years in the major leagues. I think that's kind of where some teams tend to separate. It looks like, now nobody will say, oh, we didn't take the best player. We took this guy, but he wasn't really any good. But because of the sliding system, you don't really have the same signability issues as you did in the past. You still have some, but not the same as in the past. So the question that I see where teams separate, and this is just me looking at it, is do you go with that college guy, especially at the top of the draft, thinking he can get you, he can get to the majors quicker. If he's a pitcher, he can get there really quickly. Or do you go with what you think is the best player? Do you think that that high school player in 3 years is going to be better than that college player? You take the high school player.
And I don't envy the jobs of these scouting directors and these front offices, because they have to just make so many educated guesses at this point, and it's kind of all on them. And I don't know. I just I don't know that I would want to be in that kind of position where everything's riding on the decisions I make. But, hey, that's why they do it and why we just talk about it.
That's right. Yeah, and they're around these kids so much. I mean, you look at some of the scouts that are out there, you know, beating the trail. Some of these guys, they coach travel teams, or they coach scout teams where maybe a bunch of players in that guy's area, he takes them and he coaches them. So they're in these guys' homes from like eighth or ninth grade on. So in a way, there's no way to know what a high school kid is going to be when he's a grown man, quote unquote. But as much time as they spend around these kids and their families, and I think that sometimes helps make the difference between high school players signing or not signing, that's where I think you can make a good draft pick, and also you can make a good decision just on a human being. I'm looking at the Rockies; their 11th round pick, Mike Zimmerman. He threw a perfect game and two no hitters this year. I think consecutive starts. It was a perfect game and a no hitter. And he had signed with Florida. And even just talking to people who had covered his high school games, they believed, oh, he's definitely going to Florida. I mean, he could come out as a number one, two, or three pick. But last night, he tells the local TV station, the local media down there, that he is signing a contract with the Rockies, and it turns out that that the scout involved with that had coached him at age like 12, 13, 14. So he knew him and understood. Yeah, he knew him. He knew his family, kind of knew knew the situation. It was John Cederberg who was the scout who deserves the credit on that one. But that's the way that some of these things work out, where sometimes a guy would get to the majors that maybe you're thinking, gee, why did they draft this guy? But maybe they knew something about him. They knew that he had grown X number of inches, or put on a certain amount of weight, or had gotten stronger, or had stopped playing basketball or football, or you know, he was still playing all the other sports. But once you get him into pro baseball, he can just blossom that way. So the scouts that are out there, they really do a huge job, and I mean, it's a big responsibility.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, let's talk about the Major League team a little bit. So when I thought we were going to be recording this, that it was a couple days ago, and I had been making a couple notes, that entering the final game of the weekend, they were winners of 10 of 14, those Colorado Rockies. And so I went back to check, and they just took 2 of 3 over St. Louis. So there are some happy days going on right now with these Rockies.
Now, I'll tell you what, the starting pitching is doing well, and that's something that I don't think anyone could have said, especially if you look at – if you were to tell me that their five-man rotation coming out of spring training, three of them would not be here right now, one injured for the year, Jordan Lyles, and a couple who've had to go back to the minors, Eddie Butler, who just went back to work on his off-speed stuff, and Tyler Matzik, who had just simply lost control of his delivery, and they're trying to rebuild it there. If you were to tell me that three of their five starters on opening day would not be here, I wouldn't have been confident to say that, hey, the starting rotation is a big part of this, but it is a big part of this. Guys like David Hale have come up and helped, and also Chris Rusin and Chad Bettis, who was a former number two second-round draft pick who had really lost his way as a starter last year. They rebuilt him during the offseason and early in spring training. They didn't even let him into games, but now you're seeing a good and consistent delivery. They're joining Kyle Kendrick, who's pitching much better these days, and Jorge De La Rosa, who had an outstanding outing against the Cardinals, and looks like he's healed from his various injuries and could be poised to go on a hot streak. So they're getting good starting pitching, and I'm sure, I don't think for a couple of weeks we've talked about them, but Troy Tulowitzki, Carlos Gonzalez have really turned it up lately.
Well, let's just talk a little bit more about Eddie Butler. So he just had one specific thing he needed to work on, and they seem to be pretty confident this is going to be a short-lived stint in AAA.
They do think it's that they're confident with it, and I think in a lot of cases, too, he just needed to stop back at step back and maybe take a breather here. They gave him a lot. I went back and looked at the history of pitchers that have done well at Coors Field, and most of them had 19 or more starts at the AAA level. And I think the other, Jolice Chassin, who, by the way, is pitching pretty well in the Indians organization after being cut by the Rockies, I believe he had something like 13 to 15 starts at the AAA level. Well, Eddie Butler was pulled out of AA last year when his shoulder was hurting, and he's only started one AAA game in his life. And I think that to train a guy to pitch at Coors Field, maybe you need a little bit more training before you throw him out there. I thought that his fastball got better and his just comfort out there and feeling, hey, I can throw this fastball by major league hitters. But it takes more than that, and I do believe that some of the scouting and some of the strategy was a little much for him in the beginning, but they think it'll be short, and you certainly hope that he can work on those secondary pitches and get them sharp and then come back with some confidence.
Yeah, well, then, you know, if he gets it together and you put him with some of these other guys who are having some early success, it could end up being a pretty interesting Rockies team. So we will keep our eye on that, Thomas. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to MLB.com Extras, the NL West.